when we left last week, Steve and I were homesick, so we listened online. We were with King David, right? So when, I'm going to apologize ahead of time for coughing. I'm going to do my best, but it is what it is. So tonight we're covering the books of 1st and 2nd Kings, and 2nd Chronicles, and then the Minor Prophets, which Steve's going to talk about that in a little bit. So at the end of 2 Samuel, David was king. Now at the beginning of 1 Kings, David is still king, but he's quite elderly. And if you have your Bibles, open up to 1 Kings chapter 1. So it starts out, when King David was old and well advanced in years, he could not keep warm, even when they put covers on him. So,
yeah. He's relayed, man.
Yeah, so that's pretty old. One of David's sons, named Adonijah, decides that it's time for a new king. And he decides that he's the one. So basically, he sets himself up as king. Now, you probably remember from the story of David that he had many wives, and the many wives had many sons. David's family was kind of a hot mess, to be really honest. There was, you know, if you read 1 and 2 Samuel and all of David's story, you know, his sons, let's just say they put the fun in dysfunction in their family, okay? Two of his sons have already died. One of his sons tried to steal the throne, Absalom. He died. Another son, Amnon. Despicable things. I'll let you read about it. But now Adonijah decides that he's going to be the king. And he throws a big party. He invites a lot of people. He invites all the right people. And he starts acting like the king. Well, Nathan the prophet, remember Nathan the prophet was the one who came to David with his sin with Bathsheba. Okay, so Nathan comes to Bathsheba and says, do you know what Adonijah has done? They cook up a plan to go to David and to basically tell David what's happening, but make it David's idea, kind of, that Solomon should be king. So they have a plan, they execute their plan, and sure enough, David tells Solomon, David tells Nathan exactly what to do. He says, take my son Solomon, anoint him king, ride him through town on my donkey. Kings rode donkeys, which, you know, pointing forward to Jesus Christ, when Jesus rides into Jerusalem on a donkey, that was huge, okay? Because kings rode donkeys. Well, so this happens. This is all happening at the same time. Adonijah is throwing himself a big party. I'm the new king. Nathan anoints Solomon as king, and Solomon is ridden through town on the king's donkey. Well, Adonijah learns about it and becomes very alarmed immediately, as he well should have. And evidently that was a real buzzkill because the party broke up. Everybody left. Well, Adonijah now is very afraid, and as he should be, because, you know, he's made this power play for the throne, and really he did it out of turn, so he's afraid for himself. But Solomon tells him, if you behave yourself, everything's going to be fine. If you don't, it's probably not. Well, Adonijah doesn't behave himself. Basically, he makes another try for the throne by requesting as his wife one of King David's harem. So to have the harem was to have the kingship. So anyway, Solomon hasn't taken care of. He's no more a threat, if we'll say. Okay, so Solomon has him killed. So Adonijah tries to set himself up as king. Solomon is set up as king. So now he's king. It's time for David to die. David gives Solomon some final words, some warnings, warns him about the enemies, tells him, you know, follow in the ways of the Lord and you'll be blessed and all these things. So like all the kinds of things that you would pass on to someone when you're about to die. And so David dies, and Solomon's reign is now established. One of the things that Solomon did was he did deal with all of David's enemies. And chapter 2 of Kings talks about this guy and what he did and how he was basically executed. And so that was one important thing that Solomon did that really secured his throne, that the enemies were taken care of. So now we get to 1 Kings chapter 3. Solomon is king now, and he goes to Gibeon. And it says in 1 Kings 3 that it was a high place. But if you look at what it says in 2 Chronicles, Chronicles is basically a repeat of 1 and 2 Kings, but only regarding things having to do with Judah. I'll get to that in a second. But in 1 Chronicles, or 2 Chronicles, it tells us here that this high place that he went to at Gibeon was where the tabernacle was. The tabernacle that Moses had constructed in the desert, that traveled with them for 40 years, that was their traveling temple, basically. So the tabernacle had been set up at this high place at Gibeon, and Solomon went there and he offered sacrifices to the Lord, okay? Well, that night, Solomon had a dream. And 1 Kings 3 tells us that the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said to him, ask for whatever you want me to give you. How about that? I mean, let's just pause for a moment on that. If someone asked you, someone who could deliver, if they asked you, ask me for whatever you want, and I'll give it to you, what would you ask for? I don't know, the endless possibilities. Well, this is what Solomon said, and this is in verse 5. And again, this is all in a dream, okay? Solomon answers, you have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant a king in place of my father David. But I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours? Wow. So Solomon basically tells the Lord, I have this task. You've asked me, you know, what do I want? What I want is wisdom. I want wisdom to be able to lead your people because I can't do this. It's too big. Well, the Lord is so pleased with what Solomon asked for. Because Solomon could have asked for fame and wealth and, you know, all of those things that we think are so worthy of striving for. He doesn't ask for those things. He asks for wisdom. So God is so pleased with that he says, you know what? I'm going to give you wisdom. I'm going to give you what you've asked for. But I'm also going to give you what you've not asked for, was, you know, wealth, fame, all of these things, all right? So God's pleased. God gives him wisdom. And at the end of chapter 3, we read about the famous story of King Solomon where two women come to him with one baby, and they both claim that the baby is theirs, and they both want the baby. And how do you figure out whose baby is whose? Well, he comes up with a great, you know, obviously one of them's lying, okay, because they can't both be the mother of the baby. And he says, tell you what we're going to do. We're going to saw the baby in two, and you'll each get half. Well, one woman says, no, don't saw the baby in half. Give it to her. Well, smart guy, he says she must be the mother. She gets the baby. Everybody in the kingdom is standing in awe of Solomon because of his wisdom in solving this. So that is how chapter 3 ends. And it tells us, I'm going to jump to the end of chapter 4. This is what it says about Solomon's wisdom. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight, and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than any other man, including Ethan the Ezrahite and a bunch of other guys that it names here, who I don't know. And his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. It says that he spoke 3,000 proverbs and his songs numbered 1,005. So he's a poet. He's a musician. He's a scientist. He described plant life from the cedars of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the walls. He also taught about animals and birds and reptiles and fish. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. So he wasn't just viewed as wise within the confines of Israel. He was viewed as wise in all parts of that known world. So that is Solomon and his wisdom. Now Steve is going to talk to us about Solomon the Builder. Steve?
I don't know if it's a guy thing, but I like buildings. I remember being at a church with Jeff, and we were talking about how the building was built, because Jeff's a builder. So he was telling me all about, or figuring out just by sitting in the building, about that building. Mike DeVeast and I have been on a tour of churches in the area looking at building style and art and all those kind of things. Mike Lintz and I have been on a barn tour looking at barns, because buildings are fascinating. About how they're put together, and you think about the labor, especially when you're in a church that's 100 years old or a barn that's 150 years old, and you think about the people that would have built that building using tools that we don't, and they didn't have anything to plug in a saw to just rip through stuff and whatever else. So when I think about Solomon's building, David had in his heart to build a temple for God. David wanted to build it so bad, and God said, no, you're not going to do this. Your son is. And the plans came together. And think about planning a building that is to represent God on earth. It is to be the place where people look to that and they think about God. There weren't churches on every corner like we have now. But think about being the king of Israel, and think about, what would I build? What would I build? There's a great description in the scriptures of this building that Solomon put together. First of all, the stones that were cut far away in the hills and dressed in the hills, to precision, so that when they brought them to Jerusalem, to the building site, there were no sounds of chisels on the building site. So think about the thinking that goes behind that. We're going to make everything right out there, so that when we get it here, there's not going to be a bunch of banging around and adjusting of whatever needs to happen. Solomon also contacted the king, Hiram, king of Tyre, who was in the north, who was in charge of the cedar forests of Lebanon. And there were good relations between this king and David, and so Solomon appealed to those good relations and said, listen, all those logs, I want them. And the king Hiram said, okay, you can have these. Solomon said, I'll pay your men to cut them down, and you'll float them on the sea down to Joppa, and that's where my men will pick them up. Solomon said, I'm going to pay all your men's wages that are in the forest. King Hiram said, okay, that'll be a good deal, and I want you to supply the food for my palace. for the time being. Solomon said, okay, so Solomon's sending money and food, and logs are coming. These beautiful cedars from Lebanon are coming down the river, and they're being implemented and put in there. And the king up there said, I'm also going to send you a man whose name is Huram Abi. And Huram Abi is a craftsman among craftsmen. He knows how to work metals. He knows how to work cloth. He knows how to work wood. This man is an expert. And Huram Abi worked with Solomon's men, teaching them, taking those that were already skilled and improving their skills so that all these people were working on the temple together. And the scripture talks about the numbers of people that were conscripted, the numbers of men that were in the forest, the numbers of men that were in the stone yards, bringing things in. But what fascinates me the most is the description of this place. It wasn't huge. It wasn't like a football stadium huge. It was, the temple itself was about 90 by 30 feet. Not super big. About 45 feet tall. There were porticos and so forth on the outside of the building, but the temple itself, 90 by 30 feet.
How does that relate to the size of this building?
I don't know. I was thinking about that earlier today. How long is this building, John?
100 yards is a football field.
That building would fit inside the gym.
Yeah.
Jeff, the builder, says that this building would fit inside our gym. I think you're right. Pretty close to the right.
Height-wise, too.
Yeah. And
pretty,
so...
It's pretty close, within 5 feet.
So he's got... this building comes together... And the cedars of Lebanon come down, and they are dressed. And the entire interior of this building is lined with cedar paneling.
It must smell good.
It did smell good. And then on the cedar paneling, the craftsmen that were under the charge of this man that had come down, they carved open flowers and vines and all kinds of things into that cedar. So imagine every inch of that cedar covered with these beautiful carvings. And then on the floor, they didn't leave the floor alone either. They took juniper wood, which also smells awesome, and they put juniper wood over the entire floor. And then inside the building is the area called the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant would have been placed. And they built another room within the room of cedar. And then there were two cherubim, angel figures, that had wingspans of about 15 feet, carved out of olive wood. They were both exactly the same, and they were in that inner room, that Holy of Holies. And the outside of their wings touched the walls, and the inside of their wings touched exactly in the center of that room. Then there were doors. There were inner doors and outer doors that were also made of olive or cedar, and they were carved with all kinds of palm trees and this and that and branches and more open flowers and more cherubim, and all of those were covered with carvings. And so you have this beautiful room of cedar, of juniper, an inner room of more cedar and juniper, these beautiful doors that have been carved, and then the gold comes. Every inch of those carvings, every inch of the inner room, every bit of the cherubim that had been carved out of olive wood, every bit of the doors, every bit of the door frames, every bit of these ornately carved woods was covered with gold leaf. Every bit. And then, when they get done gilding all of the interior, they gild the floor. They gilded the floor. I would pay a nickel to see that. I would pay more than a nickel for that tour of that room that was gold on gold on gold. Gold chains hanging from the ceiling as ornamentation. It was as beautiful as you can imagine and more beautiful than those people could make it. Because God was in every bit of it. So I want to go. I want to see what it was like. I really do. In 7 years, they built that thing. And it was time to dedicate it. And so they went to Gibeon, the place that Julie mentioned, and they got the Ark of the Covenant, the box that held the tablets that God had given Moses. And they carried it into the city, and in the temple at the time there were 120 priests that were playing instruments, playing trumpets, playing lyres, playing drums, and singing God's love endures forever as this thing comes in through the doors. Can you imagine? And then they bring it into this smaller room, the room they called the Holy of Holies, and when they set it down, the place filled with smoke to the point that the priests could not do what they were doing anymore. They couldn't sing. They couldn't play the trumpets. They couldn't see to hit their tambourines. And so they had to leave. And smoke is rolling out of this building, not because it's on fire, but because the presence of God is there. And then they partied. Oh, did they party. Bull after bull after bull, goat after sheep after goat after sheep were sacrificed there that day. It was huge. And in Chronicles it says that when the initial offering was prepared, God sent fire from the sky to light that offering. And up it went, and the barbecue happens, and the people ate, and the people partied, and the priests played their instruments, and it was the biggest day of celebration that they had seen. Kings and Chronicles both talk about the things that that Solomon had to say to the people, and the people's response, and all that went on that day. But I want to read to you a portion of the exchange between God and Solomon. On this day of celebration, when the party's going and everything is big, it says that God appeared to Solomon. And this is what it says in 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 4. God says to Solomon, "As for you, if you walk before me faithfully with integrity of heart and uprightness as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father when I said, 'You shall never fail to have a successor on the throne of Israel.' But if you or your descendants turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you, and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I have given them. I will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name. Israel will then become a byword, an object of ridicule among all people. This temple that you just finished in gold, this temple that I just filled with smoke, this temple that was the cause of celebration today, this temple will become a heap of rubble. All who pass by will be appalled and will scoff and say, 'Why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple?' People will answer, 'Because they have forsaken the Lord their God, who brought their ancestors out of Egypt, and they have embraced other gods, worshiping and serving them. That is why the Lord brought all this disaster on them.'" God delivered a very clear warning that day. The warning that we have been talking about since Genesis. The warning is the same. If you forsake me, things will go poorly, very poorly. I also need to let you know that Solomon built a palace, a big palace, way bigger than the temple. It took him 13 years to build the palace. 7 years to build the temple, 13 years to build the palace. I got to think that there were ladies on the committee for the palace. He had many wives, and there were probably a lot of changes which may have delayed the construction. I'm just guessing.
They made snacks.
Do we want that window here? But anyway, he built the temple. He built the palace. And I wanted to tell you about all the gold and all the furnishings of the temple to illustrate to you how rich Solomon's kingdom was. They were at the top. They could do this, and they did it because they could. Okay? So those are some pictures that I want you to carry in your mind as we go back to Julie at the news desk.
So, things are going pretty well for Solomon. The temple's built. Palaces are built. He's got all kinds of wisdom. He's got lots of wealth. Ships. I mean, it's good in Israel. Okay? Queen of Sheba visits. That's chapter 10 of 1 Kings. Quite a visit. They were quite taken with each other. Lots of expensive gifts changed hands. This is what it says in 1 Kings chapter 10 at the end about King Solomon. He was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. Year after year, everyone who came brought a gift, articles of silver and gold, robes, weapons and spices, and horses and mules. Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horses, which he kept in the chariot cities and also within Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills. Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and from Kew. The royal merchants purchased them from Kew. They imported a chariot from Egypt for 600 shekels, blah, 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 blah. So Solomon is a pretty big deal, right? Well, so my next question is, how can someone so wise become such a fool? We're going to look at Solomon's downfall. So I would like, if you would, to flip back to Deuteronomy, chapter 17. If you remember from our study, Deuteronomy was Moses' last long speech before he died and before Israel headed into the Promised Land. And he reviews the law. He reviews their history. He reminds them of all God's decrees. This is what it says in Deuteronomy 17, starting at verse 14, okay? When you enter the land your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us like all the other nations around us, be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your own brothers. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not a brother Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself, or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law, taken from that of the priests who are Levites. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his brothers, and turn from the law to the right or to the left. Then he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel. So this is what the Lord instructed them a long time ago that the king was supposed to do. This is what Solomon did. God said the king must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself. How many horses did we read that he had? 12,000. God didn't say how many is a lot. That sounds like a lot of horses. God also said, don't go back to Egypt to get horses. Where did they go to get their horses?
Egypt.
And why did God say, don't go to Egypt? Don't go back there. I rescued you from there. Don't go back. Now, those might seem like no big deal things to us. Like, they're horses. What? You know, Egypt happened a long time ago. What? No big deal. Well, God also said he must not take many wives or his heart will be led astray. Let's look at what it says in the first verses of chapter 11 of 1 Kings. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter: Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. I think that qualifies as many wives.